of the National Association of Scholars. Long ago, I was a bookish lad growing up in Brooklyn, and I believed myself to be one of the Lord's anointed, that is to say, an intellectual. Now, of course, I didn't quite believe in the Lord, but I did nonetheless think that he had anointed me to make up for his absence. And I think a great many intellectuals share that set of beliefs. I said I've come a long way. I'm the head of an organization of academics and intellectuals. But in looking at the problems of academia and American culture, I've finally come to the conclusion, as Walt Kelly once had it, that I have met the enemy and they are us. One of the things I believed in my younger days was that intellectuals, being the Lord's anointed, had a vocation to lift everyone else, to use that heathenish Menconian spin on the notion of anointment, to lift the great unwashed out of the benighted state into which they had fallen, and to a level of enlightenment that at least was roughly comparable to that which folks like myself could attain. And when the problems of the academy began to show themselves in a way that I recognized back in the 60s and 70s, it seemed to me, and it seemed to a lot of other people who were the first wave of efforts to kind of recall the academy to what they thought it should be, the first wave of reform, so to speak, it seemed to us that we were dealing with some sort of strange anomaly. We had all come to believe that the great unwashed were indeed the problem in academic life, that it was their episodic intrusions into academic life which were the major threat to the pursuit of truth. They might be political demagogues, Joe McCarthy. They might be religious zealots. They might simply be ignorant folk who didn't really understand the nature of the life of the mind, perhaps sitting on a board of trustees, major donor, somebody of that kind. These were the dangers, the sources of danger to the pursuit of truth. But of course, what we discovered and what we now have to grapple with is the fact that the great danger comes from within the academic and intellectual community. We thought we were unimpeachable in our commitment to truth, in part because we were romantics and took the narrative of science as being normative for all intellectuals. Science as being the great, rigorous, disinterested, methodical, evidentiary-based effort to find out what the truth really was. We thought that that enterprise, very successful in the natural spheres, was something that could be taken as emblematic of what intellectuals did wish to do in all spheres. But, you know, if you take a look at the longer history of not only intellectuals, but even the Western University, Russ Neely brought this point out very well in talking about early American colleges, antebellum American higher education. It has not basically been a great enterprise disinterested intellectually in the pursuit of truth, even if we admit, and I think there are problematic aspects of about an enterprise like that taken as an absolute. But certainly the history of Western higher education doesn't embody anything like that. If you take a look at medieval and early modern universities, up till in Europe sometime in the early to mid-19th century, they were basically institutions, and a lot of good intellectual work went on in them. I'm not trying to suggest that the life of the mind was dead within their walls, but they were basically institutions whose first and foremost commitment was the promulgation of doctrine, religious doctrine, but also civil doctrine. If you recall, there were three faculties, the higher three faculties. There was a fourth faculty, which was preparatory, the arts faculty, but in medieval and early modern universities, there were three higher faculties. One was medicine, which was, interestingly enough, the only vocational specialty for which the university had a role. But the other two were theology and the law. And in both cases, they were meant to develop and transmit an orthodoxy. Some differences of views were allowed, but basically there was an orthodox position. And also to train people for roles in running the edifice of state and church. Secular rulers as well as religious dignitaries were very interested in creating universities, because out of those universities came the civil and canon lawyers who were the bulwark of those early bureaucracies. So it's not true that universities, taken in a sort of normative sense, what they've typically done, have been about the open-ended search for truth, and therefore it's not all that an anomaly now to see them going back to being places that are doctrinal. I think the doctrines are a good deal worse than they used to be in many respects, but nonetheless, it's not all that much of a surprise. Nor perhaps is it all that surprising that intellectuals themselves are not the greatest of truth seekers, because intellectuals, like most other people, want first and foremost, I would think, something that Adam Smith recognized with respect to, what was it, bakers and butchers and brewers. It wasn't out of their benevolence or out of their desire to prepare the greatest beer and bread and cuts of meat that they did their work. They did their work not to give us great meals. They did their work in order to make a living in the world. Well, that's true of intellectuals as well, and often if the environment isn't quite propitious, the kind of best path to making a living in the world is intellectual stability. The truth is destabilizing. The truth results in upheavals. The truth creates uncertainties. If you're interested in making a predictable career, and if you're interested as part of a general sort of intellectual class at having a certain amount of authority, then the destabilizing search for truth may not quite be your cup of tea. Under some circumstances, it might. Again, in the sciences, we'll hear in this panel some reports about even the corrupting elements of orthodoxy in the sciences, but in the sciences, it may work relatively well. In the less rigorous areas of life, I think it's worked much more poorly. Again, when I talk about doctrine, which, if you want a more benign term, could be translated into, or roughly translated into, something like received wisdom, I'm not suggesting that that is not a legitimate function of the university. I think transmission of knowledge is probably, in the end, more important as a function, assuming that knowledge has some grounding in reality, than the promotion of critical thought. Students can't really be expected to go out there and reinvent civilization. The institutions of education have to transmit the basis of civilization from generation to generation. And that involves some accepted notions of what civilization is and what reality is. So that's a function, but it's not quite the same thing, and sometimes runs afoul in dramatic ways of truth-seeking. Well, this panel is going to take a look at the way in which truth-seeking is now being impeded within our universities, and is going to look at it from a number of interesting angles, including what's going on in some of the scientific realms and in some of the pseudo-scientific realms. We have three exceptionally qualified people on this panel. Let me just briefly introduce them before they come up to the mic. Jane Shaw Stroop, who's president of the John W. Pope Center, a very estimable institution with a wonderful website, and great commentary from Jane and George Leaf, who's out here in the audience today and will be on the program later, a tremendous resource. Prior to coming to the Pope Foundation, which is down in North Carolina, she was communication director and senior fellow of PERC, a nonprofit institute that encourages market-based solutions to environmental problems. So she knows her environmental science and her environmental law. And I think we have John Bowden here, too, don't we? I saw him earlier, who I believe is still at PERC, is that right?
No.
No? All right. But he certainly was a great mover within PERC for a long time. She's also past president of the Association of Private Enterprise Education and a senior editor of Liberty Magazine. Second person on the program is my own colleague at the National Association of Scholars, Peter Wood. He is not, let me repeat this several times, he is not the provost of the King's College in New York City. He's not the provost of the King's College because I stole him away from the King's College several years back to become the executive director and now the president of the National Association of Scholars. I can't begin to tell you what an impressive fellow Peter is in every respect. He has a commanding knowledge of the malfeasances as well as the ideals of American higher education in all its aspects, and has been among the first to catch on to and to warn against the various intellectual dodges that are put forward in the name of reason and truth discovery, but in fact are simply a veil for academic power grabs. He was the author of a book called Diversity, the Invention of a Concept, which told the story of that particular shibboleth. And more recently, he has discovered that there is another on its way, perhaps to seize the mantle of ideological leadership from diversity, and that is sustainability. He'll talk more about that later. And finally, Thor Halvorsen, who is an exceptional person in a whole lot of ways, a genuine hero in one particular way, in a way that most academics don't find themselves in a heroic position comparable to what he has assumed. He's president of the Human Rights Foundation, which is a worldwide organization advocating human rights in its genuine form, rather than, again, in the leftist perversion of the notion of human rights that we more frequently see. He was instrumental in the founding of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, FIRE, which just 2 days ago celebrated its 10th anniversary and served as its first executive director and CEO. He's also the founder of the Motion Picture Institute and has produced several films, including Indoctrinate You, which I think many of you here have had a chance to see, a very powerful deconstruction of the politically correct regime on our campuses. He's also, though his name wouldn't suggest it, a native of Venezuela, and has taken a very prominent position in the effort to unseat the current tyrant of Venezuela, Hugo Chavez. And that, of course, is a kind of an activity that you involve yourself in at a good deal more peril than taking on even the forces of political correctness on the American campus. So I think we have to kind of deeply recognize and appreciate his willingness to do things like that. So, having said what I said, let me now turn the floor over. Each of our speakers will have 15 minutes, and then hopefully we'll have a fair amount of time for Q&A and back and forth. Jane, why don't you lead off?